Podcasts of Homegrown are made possible thanks to support from listeners like you. Consider becoming a member of WFPL by calling 502-814-6565 or at the website wfpl.org. Thanks. Welcome back to Homegrown. I'm Janine Wishy.
I am Bob Hill.
And today on the show, extremely important show because this is what really lays the foundation of all of horticulture, all of agriculture, everything, the whole planet.
I'm glad I'm here.
The soil. It's so important. People just simply
take it for granted.
They take it for granted. They don't understand it. They throw all this you-know-what on it and not really appreciate the life that's going on there and then the life that it gives us in return. How about that?
And what a matter, how it really matters in terms of getting the plants you want in the right place and the right kind
of
stuff.
And have them do well.
Yeah.
Yeah. So we're going to sort through the details of soil with agronomist and Purdue Extension agent John Orrick, talk about what soil structure is, what nutrition is, what the pH means in terms of nutrition, what nitrogen does, what potassium does, what, you know, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, I met John a couple weeks ago at a Master Gardener conference in Indiana, and he was a joy to listen to because he likes what he does, and he educates people, and he knows his stuff, and he's kind of a minister, a preacher of the soil.
A soil scientist.
Yeah. Uh-huh. And he just does a good job. He'll explain what you need to get things started.
Sounds good. And beyond that, we're going to talk to P. Allen Smith. That name may ring a bell for some of you who watch fancy TV and gardening shows.
That's right. Clean bib overalls.
Several books out as well. But P. Allen Smith is going to talk to us about sort of designing, planning, preparing, and planting the spring vegetable garden. What are the types of things that can go in now so we can start enjoying our own bounty from the garden? And as Bob said, or I've heard him say that, you know, carrots cost $27 a stick. So, you know, more people are going to start gardening.
Yep.
So we're going to have all the information you need today on Homegrown. So we still hope that you stick with us. Bob, what is going on in your garden?
I'm going to start gardening.
Good. Me too. I'm going to talk about that too.
Well, I am a little bit. I had this raised bed I tried for years.
Back to vegetable gardening?
Yeah, I am going. We're going back. Yeah.
I know you had to do a little bit here and there.
Yeah, I had a neat raised bed. It was about 6-8 feet by 12-14 feet. Mm-hmm. And it didn't work as well as I'd hoped, frankly. And I'm going to tear it out, take all that wonderful soil I've spent years and till it into my soil. Mm-hmm. We're going to have a vegetable garden, an honest to God vegetable garden.
Good, good, good.
Also, I'm starting my annual plants. I love tall zinnias and cosmos. I'm going to concentrate on those guys. I love those big old plants.
Everybody should plant them.
And I'm starting them from seed just for emotional reasons. Mm-hmm. I need to get something going. Yeah. So,
actually, I started some tomatoes and some peppers just the other day.
There you go.
Seed starting, you know, in the house. Because it's the same thing. It's time to do it anyway. Mid-March is the time to do it. You look at the back of the packet in terms of those, you know, crops that we have to wait to put out until after that frost-free date. The summer crops, you know, it takes them a while to get to a good size. So you can get a start on it right now by doing some seed starting. And, Bob, things are starting to come in the mail, too. That are those mid-March types of things that you can actually plant. So my leek slips are arriving.
All right.
I'll be planting leeks, and my onion slips are arriving. Loads of onions.
Yep.
And best of all, potatoes.
Spuds.
So yeah, all that, it's time to get all of that in the ground. As long as the soil's not too wet, as long as it's workable, you don't want to destroy that soil structure by working wet soil. But yeah, mid-March, and what did Daddy always say? Once the forsythia begins to bloom, you can pretty much start to do everything.
That's when I start to bloom too. Actually,
I think me too. And usually it's mid March.
The yellow Bob.
Who needs St. Patrick's Day when you've got the forsythia?
Who needs February?
No kidding.
Get rid of it.
No kidding. Oh boy. Yes, we are in the month of March, which is good news on the calendar. UDEL March 21st. A very appropriate, I think, class that they're offering. Arborist Robert Rollins is going to do a pruning demonstration, basically. And I know a lot of folks probably have still pruning chores to do, and the best thing that you can do is learn how to prune properly, and Robert Rollins can teach you how.
So they don't call him seven-fingered Robert for nothing.
You can find out more information about that workshop out at UDEL by visiting our website at wfpl.org. All right, to the soil, Bob.
Exactly.
The foundation of it all, and John Orrick is joining us.
Yeah, John is the extension educator with Purdue University's Cooperative Extension Service in Madison County, Indiana, which is a little bit northwest of Indianapolis. His work includes working with turf and soil and master gardeners, and today he's going to help homegrown listeners better understand soil science, pH, and the component parts of manufactured fertilizer, as well as the benefits of organic fertilizers. John, welcome to Homegrown.
It's good to be here.
Let's begin about as basic as possible. Generally, what exactly is our soil and where did it all come from? All that stuff covering the planet here.
Well, soil is basically a mixture of weathered minerals. Air and water are large components of soil, as well as living and dead animals and plants that are being decomposed by very important microorganisms, as well as insects and earthworms and other critters like that that help the soil become what we call formed mm-hmm. or made.
So, John, what's the subtle difference between, you know, clay soils? Why are some areas very clay, others loamy, others sandy?
Well, you're speaking of the clays and loams and sands, and that refers to the textures of the soil.
Okay.
All soil really contains clay, silt, and sand.
Mm-hmm.
And what causes the differences is based on what parent material it was formed from, whether a glacier came through and changed the topography or changed the parent material or the caused differences in how that soil was made or weathered mm-hmm. or formed in that particular area.
Okay.
If you think about, you know, of course I'm from Indiana, the northern part of Indiana is a soil that was derived from a glacial till or outwash.
Mm-hmm.
And in those areas, you've got real flat, fertile farmland, whereas the southern part of Indiana is got a very hilly topography, rocky soils, very weathered soils, and so the structure and the soil makeup is much different.
So I guess, too, like when you look at floodplain areas where silt would be deposited on a more regular basis over the course of history, that makes soil richer as well? Not necessarily.
Not necessarily. Okay. And some of those flat bottom areas like that can also be fairly sandy because of the flooding that occurs each year.
Mm-hmm.
What makes a soil fertile and rich for growing plants is the amount of organic matter and the right amount of sand, silt, and clay. And of course we're going to have a hard time finding the perfect soil, and a lot of people, horticulturalists and soil scientists, say that, you know, a loam texture is probably the best texture. That means you're about 40% I think it's about 40% silt, about 40% clay, and about 20% sand, and they say that's a pretty perfect texture. But
texture doesn't necessarily mean fertility or other stuff, right?
No, it doesn't. Okay. But it does affect water holding capacity and nutrient holding capacity.
Okay.
But a person, if they've got a heavy clay soil, which we often see in a new building site, you know, where they've scraped away the topsoil that is usually very high in organic matter,
mm-hmm.
you're left with this very high clay subsoil. And
that's the worst soil.
Yeah, that's bad stuff, you know. That's
yeah.
like that concrete that you're digging into when you're planting your new landscaping around your brand new home.
Mm-hmm.
That causes some problems, and it can often be poorly drained, and that usually causes problems, especially with, I think, yew bushes, and people try to plant rhododendrons
mm-hmm.
And things like that. Those kind of shrubs don't like wet feet or wet roots, as we call it. And so a person can check the drainage in the soil by digging a hole and pouring a bucket of water in there and seeing if it's drained overnight. If it hasn't drained, you want to choose a new spot.
You got a problem.
Yeah, or John, put some tile in there, yeah.
We'll talk about a little later about, you know, the fertilizer and how to fix this clay soil, but let's set
sure.
the stage a little more by talking about soil pH. What is that? And we'll talk about how it affects plant growth a little later.
Yeah, pH is basically a measure of the acidity or alkalinity of a soil. And pH is important for gardeners and horticulturalists because it affects the uptake or the availability of certain nutrients for plants. And then we've also got some plants that really grow better in either a lower pH or more of a higher or neutral pH.
So it's all about either binding or delivering nutrients and how pH is linked to that in that particular plant.
Yeah, the most important thing is that it gives you a clue as to whether your particular soil type is suitable for growing certain plants and whether they can, like you say, take up or make available the nutrients that are needed for that plant to grow. And the soil pH affects that greatly. One of the examples we see here is that because our soils are derived from limestone, which causes the pH to be high,
mm-hmm.
Well, in that case, pin oaks, for example, can't take up iron. So we see a lot of pin oak trees with yellow leaves and stunted growth and branches that have died back because it can't utilize the iron that's in that particular soil.
So there could be a ton of iron there, but since the pH is not right, it will never get to it, so to speak.
Yeah, that's correct.
Okay.
And one way to correct that, there's two different ways. I mean, you could try to lower the pH, or a lot of people try to supplement iron directly into the tree, either by liquid injections, foliar sprays, or little capsules that can be inserted into the trunk of that tree.
And does that work?
Yeah, it works for a time period.
Okay. It's a quick fix, not a long
forever.
Term. Okay.
Yeah.
Well, since we're talking about nutrient uptake, what are the basic nutrients that a plant needs, most plants?
Well, there are actually 16 essential plant nutrients. But when we buy a fertilizer, there are three what we call macronutrients, or they're needed in large amounts, that we will see primary in most fertilizers, and that's nitrogen, phosphorus, and potassium. And so we see those as the main components of most of our synthetic fertilizers.
That's the number on the package. 10-10-10 is 10% of the
right.
And 20-10-10 is high nitrogen. 30-0-0 is like
right.
Ammonia, pure nitrogen.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and really it's the percent nitrogen. It's the percent P2O5, which is a fancy chemical name for phosphoric acid,
mm-hmm.
and then soluble potash, K2O. But we can say it's nitrogen, phosphorus, and potassium.
And those are percents of 100. 10-10-10
yes.
is 70% inert ingredients, right?
Right.
So people understand that.
Yeah, and those inert ingredients have no nutrient value.
Okay.
But they're important because it helps distribute the nitrogen, phosphorus, and potassium evenly over your garden or your lawn or wherever you're applying the fertilizer.
Mm-hmm. So what are some of the other top trace elements? You said that there were 16 altogether.
Yeah.
So what are some of the top trace elements?
Well, you hear a lot about iron.
Mm-hmm.
And, in relation to pin oaks, manganese is also one of those. Sulfur is one. Magnesium, calcium. Some of those are not trace elements, which mm-hmm. are needed in just small amounts.
Okay.
I know iron and manganese are. Copper and boron. Molybdenum, which is fun
course.
To say on the radio.
Would you spell that for us, please?
Four times fast. But those are some of the ones
okay.
that are needed in small amounts,
uh-huh.
but maybe not as important as N, P, and K.
Uh-huh. So N, P, and K, back to what are the primary functions, in that general sense? What does nitrogen do? What does phosphorus do? And what does potassium do for plant health?
Generally, all of these nutrients or all these elements are either a component in the plant or they're needed by the plant to complete its life cycle. And so that's what defines an essential element. The nitrogen becomes really essential part of most of the plant's compounds and, affects the root growth, leaf growth. In turf, which is my specialty, it affects the carbohydrate storage, and it's important if you put that late fall fertilization on mm-hmm. to offer some nitrogen for that plant to store as carbohydrates. Phosphorus promotes early growth and rooting, seed germination. So we see a lot of starter fertilizers. All of our starter fertilizers have high phosphorus rates.
Okay.
And then potassium is needed in the water relations between cells, the translocation of sugars and starch, disease resistance, and that sort of thing.
The problem being, if you have too much nitrogen, it'll accentuate the leaf growth at the expense of the other
fruit in a garden situation.
Right.
You know, the poorly timed nitrogen application to a tomato plant can be not a good thing for the home gardener, because it causes excessive leaf growth at the expense of
bloom
or fruit production. And so we say, you know, side dress tomatoes. I think I heard one of our speakers here a couple of weeks ago, Bob, say that it should be just as the fruit starts to blush, you know, and that extra nitrogen helps that fruit to continue to mature properly and to help increase production.
Now, we haven't talked about the soil test as we do every spring, which, of course, tells the gardener what
what's
plant
there,
needs.
Yeah.
So talk about that.
Soil test. Soil tests can be, really, they can be done in the fall or spring. And generally, that will tell you phosphorus and potassium levels for your particular crop. And you would want to test taking several subsamples from a given area, say your vegetable garden, and then combine that into one composite sample. Because obviously, the soil is going to vary even throughout a small garden. And so to get a representative sample, that's what we'd want to do. And you'd send about a cup of soil into a certified soil test lab. And they would tell you phosphorus and potassium, probably percent organic matter, your cation exchange capacity, which is the capacity of that soil to basically hold nutrients. And they would tell you the pH. And that's the best way to find out this information about your soil. We see a lot of electronic meters for pH or nutrient test kits in the garden centers. Some of the chemical test kits for home gardeners that you can buy may give a ballpark figure on pH and things, but none of them are as good as a certified soil test lab.
Okay, so this year there's a lot of people going to be going back to gardening, I suspect, vegetable gardening, and the first-time gardeners eager to try. Is there a general recommendation for people to what to use to get started for, with fertilizers in their soil?
Well, my recommendation is to look up your local extension office and look for those publications that give the fertilizer recommendations for those individual crops. It's different depending on the crop that you're trying to grow, and so there isn't a general rule of thumb recommendation for all plants or crops. It's all different.
Yeah. So, John, when we think about, you know, we're talking about fertility, and most people old-fashioned, you know, manufactured, commercial, 10-10-10 versus a composted organic matter. Can we take it one step beyond in terms of not just soil fertility, but also soil health? You know, earlier on you talked about the microorganisms and different things that are in soil. So the sort of commercial versus composted organic matter, using that to improve your soil, what's the give and take there?
Well, what a commercial fertilizer does, and there are some of these nutrient properties in, like, composted manures, and manures need to be composted, not fresh. And if you put a manure on that is uncomposted in some way, it needs to be put on in the fall and incorporated or tilled into the soil. So that it can properly decompose or become composted. And what manures and compost do for the soil is that it improves its structure. It improves the ability of the soil to hold water, but yet drain at the same time. With the right size aggregates in the soil, you can have the right amount of pore space along with the ability to hold water and nutrients for growth. And so, and when we talked about that heavy clay soil adding organic matter, any kind of composted organic matter, can improve that heavy clay soil dramatically. It'll also add nutrients, but more than that, and probably more important than that, it improves the soil structure. Mm-hmm. And another way of doing that is growing a cover crop in the fall on that particular garden.
And how does the cover crop work?
Basically, you're growing a crop over winter. Mm-hmm. After all the crops are done or just as they're finishing, you can sow buckwheat or winter wheat or rye, winter rye, cereal rye, on your garden and let it grow through the winter and early spring and then rototill it in the spring before you plant. And so it'll give you some good characteristics. Mm-hmm. It'll help improve the soil fertility and structure and also give you a natural mulch.
Mm-hmm. So when it's growing, though, does it actually take anything from the atmosphere and return it to the soil? Or is it really just, you know, that the structure part of it that's going to improve the soil?
Yeah, it's the organic matter part. Okay. I mean, you're making good use of, number one, space within that garden, and sure. You are taking in, you know, sunlight energy. Mm-hmm. And it's utilized by a plant. Some of those plants, there are some legumes that will take nitrogen basically from the atmosphere and convert it to soil nitrogen that can be used by plants later on. So you do have some cover crops that do that. But hairy vetch being one of them, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
So that's another way to add organic matter. That's a really beneficial thing. The commercial fertilizers add just a supplement at the right time.
Okay.
And you can find those at a higher and more controlled percentage of nutrients. You have a better idea. You have an exact idea of how much nutrient you're adding to the soil with a commercial grade fertilizer, one that's synthetically made rather than, you know, composted manure or some other source.
Well, that's the question. For the organic gardener who's totally averse to using any kind of manufactured product,
yes.
Is there a way to add the nitrogen, potassium, and phosphorus to the soil without buying a bag of 10-10-10?
Well, there are some, you know, I know at least in the turf world, in the lawn care world, there are some organically processed fertilizers, and they were really processed from poultry manure.
Mm-hmm.
And they had an analysis on the bag and were actually processed so that you could, and formulated so that you could spread those on turf. And I'm sure in the, you know, the garden world, in the vegetable gardening world, there would be also sources. Certainly your composted manures have nitrogen, phosphorus, and potassium and other nutrients in those manure sources.
Well, and like the like fish emulsion and sea kelp, liquefied sea kelp and cottonseed meal and alfalfa meal, all of those can provide, like, you know, if you mix it all in the right ratio, all those would supply a little bit of those things as well, wouldn't they?
Sure. Mm-hmm. I'm not as familiar with those products.
Okay. That's usually I need something.
Yeah, well, when one is using something like that, if it's new to you, mm-hmm. and this goes for anything new,
sure,
I would use it in on a small portion of the garden,
mm-hmm.
maybe one or two plants.
Yeah,
let's see what happens to these plants when I use this. And so I'm not certainly not against organic forms of nutrients or other organic products, other than you really want to read the label carefully. And also maybe try it on a small portion of your garden before just going hog wild, so to speak, with manure and going over the whole entire garden with something new.
Because the packages that I read, the percentages of these various additives aren't as high as you get in manufactured stuff, but it, you know, it seems to work. A lot of people use it.
Yeah, sure. And there are many products out there, and we're getting more and more products as we are becoming more green-focused, so to speak, environmentally focused as a nation. The one warning, though, especially on manures, you need to wash produce thoroughly. You need to make sure it's composted manure. You need to also beware of any punctured fruit that might come out of that garden, because whenever you puncture a piece of fruit, you know, whatever it might be as far as vegetables or fruit coming out of the garden, you also open up that fruit for contaminants, pathogens that can come from manure sources such as E. coli. And
my working theory, John, is if it still smells like poop, don't use it.
that's a good one.
Is that a good one?
That would be a very good theory.
All right, thank you.
That's our story. We're sticking to
it. That's right. Thank you so much. We appreciate it.
Excellent job, John. Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you.
John Orrick is an extension educator with the Purdue University Cooperative Extension Service in Madison County, Indiana. For more information on John or soil testing, or how you can better use chemicals and organic materials, visit the Homegrown page at WFPO.org.
After the break, P. Allen Smith discusses the actual spring vegetable garden, how to prepare it, and what to plant. You're listening to Homegrown on 89.3 WFPO. Welcome back to Homegrown. I'm Janine Wishy.
Bob Hill, right with you, kid.
All right, and it's spring garden planting time.
Yep.
Have you gotten anything planted yet?
Only in my mind.
Only in your mind.
counts.
I've started because the onions arrived in the mail, the potatoes arrived, so all of those things are being planted. Greens, peas, that sort of thing. But there's a whole slew of other types of things that we can plant in the spring garden. If you've never gardened before, now's the time to, I guess, get your fingernails a little dirty.
Yeah,
right?
Actually, as like I said earlier, seed sales are up this year.
Uh-huh.
They really are.
I believe it.
There was a story on that. Mm-hmm. So people have got the message.
And if it's any indication, just in terms of the people that we interact with, that I talk to, more people, younger people are interested in vegetable gardening for the very first time.
The victory gardens are back.
Mm-hmm, which is good news for all of us. But to sort of, I guess, whet your appetite and maybe give you some ideas, we've invited P. Allen Smith on Homegrown today. He's the host of P. Allen Smith Gardens and P. Allen Smith Garden Home. He's a regular on NBC's Today Show and the author of several books, most recently Bringing in the Outdoors. Today, he's going to help us design and plant a little spring vegetable garden. Allen, welcome to Homegrown, and thanks for joining us.
It's a thrill to be on the line with you today.
Oh, well, thank you so much. You're so kind. Listen, help us conceive of a little design for a small garden plot in an urban or suburban backyard, you know, something that's going to be certainly functional, but also handsome. I think people, you know, that makes it more fun if you can incorporate a little vegetable garden that sort of flows with the rest of your landscape.
Absolutely. You know, Janine, I'm a big believer in divide and conquer. I think so often we look out and we see the space that we have and we go, oh, heavens, where do I start? And I've always been a big believer in taking a small area and start with something that is containable, that you can get your hands around, that you can possibly put together in a couple of weekends. Mm-hmm. I suggest raised beds. Mm-hmm. I have a downtown property where those who've watched the show for years will know this. It's the gray house with the white picket fence around it. And in the back, I have two sides of my vegetable garden. It's on either side of the tool shed. And I have raised beds. And you cannot believe the amount of produce that comes out of that tiny space. Now, these raised beds create sort of a geometrical grid, so you get this interesting pattern going on, so it makes it attractive. Mm-hmm. And even if I'm growing indeterminate tomatoes that, as you know, can go all over the place,
right,
living up to the idea that a tomato is a vine, I use interesting things in these beds, like a tutur of some form or some interesting vertical element to support that tomato. Mm-hmm. This past year, I grew some interesting things like a hyacinth bean vine, which were just gorgeous through late summer right into the fall. The other is Malabar spinach, which is delicious and a really good-looking vine to grow in the center of these little raised beds. So you can really have a lot of fun. I mean, it comes from, it's historically based, it's basically a potager, or a little kitchen garden. And in the middle of these beds, I'll also maybe put pots of herbs. In my part of the world, that's really about the only way I can grow lavender very well is to grow the lavender in pots with really well-drained soil. Mm-hmm. And if you think about four of these beds in a grid, about 3 feet apart, each one about 4 feet square, and then a container, the same size container in all four. I mean, it's got instant good-looking style, mm-hmm. and you can grow a lot of fun things.
Well, Al, how much sun is required to make the backyard garden work, the vegetable garden?
You know, Bob, I really think you need full sun. You know, if you've got much shade, you can probably grow some of the greens this time of year when there aren't leaves on the trees. You know, we're already setting out, you know, cabbage, a lot of the cool season vegetables, such as broccoli and Brussels sprouts and collards and things like that, and certainly a lot of lettuce. After that, once those leaves come out on the trees, it's much tougher.
Mm-hmm. So full sun.
Yeah.
So what about, before we get into talking about the actual spring crops that people can start with at this point,
Yeah. What
about the concept of raised beds? Is a fabulous concept because I think it makes the whole process a lot easier in so many different ways, whether you're working
Janine
with it.
And everybody that I talk to, they go, oh, my soil is so bad.
Exactly.
I could never grow anything mm-hmm. in my soil. So if you raise the beds, you can just prepare the soil in that space mm-hmm. and get it right. That's what I mean by this divide and conquer,
mm-hmm.
and not try to feel like you're taking over the entire, have to take over the entire planet to plant a garden.
Mm-hmm. So what do you recommend in terms of the soil amendments and the composition of the soil that you bring in to fill these raised beds?
Yeah, I if you follow my website, pialensmith.com, and have followed what we've done out at the Garden Home Retreat, you know, it's all organic. And
mm-hmm.
and even in that big garden, it's big. I mean, it's like the size of 3 football fields, the length of it anyway. And it's all in raised beds. I'm putting in an acre vegetable garden right now, which will not have raised beds. It'll only have one raised bed, which will be 8 by 24. 8 by 24 feet. And this year, I'm going to show how much produce I can grow in that raised bed.
Mm-hmm.
So we're doing this with Bonnie Plant Farm, and we're filling that thing up, and we're going to weigh it through the season.
Mm-hmm.
But the mixture that I like to use is one part the soil that comes out of the bed, I mean,
mm-hmm.
or your soil.
Sure.
I have heavy clay. It's, you know, clay, there's nothing wrong with clay. It's often nutrient rich, but I take one part that to one part some form of humus. It can be really well decomposed leaves. You can go buy bag material if you don't have that. I love to use, I use a blend that has mycorrhizae in it from ProMix that we mix in there with it, and then I do a half part sand. And what you want to do is you want to be able, once you blend all that together and you squeeze it mm-hmm. in your hand, it needs to fall apart.
Mm-hmm.
It does not need to remain in a ball.
Like mm-hmm. our clay soil would.
Right.
If you don't amend it, it'll stay. Yeah, it'll. You can make a clay ball, and if it dries, it'll be hard as a rock.
Gotcha.
Yeah, Alan, for a lot of reasons, environmental as well as economic, a lot of first-time gardeners are digging back in again this year, so to speak. So
yeah.
What basic plants would you recommend for spring that might be sort of foolproof for them?
Yeah, you know, I think the economy and I think just yeah, we're all just kind of getting back to basics, and I think that everybody knows that gardening is good for you in a lot of ways. I tell you, I have always been I love to grow broccoli. It's so easy. I love mm-hmm. to grow lettuce. Lettuce is so easy. You can grow lettuce in containers. I grow beautiful butter crunch bib lettuce every year.
Mm-hmm.
I grow beautiful romaine lettuce. And you can grow these from seed, but I recommend on the lettuces, even the lettuces today, you can buy 6 packs of them.
Mm-hmm.
Or you can buy broccoli already sprouted I recommend if you're just getting started, go ahead and pick up the plants. But don't get too, you know, we've got a full season here of a lot of cool season vegetables you can grow before you even start getting into the tomatoes and the peppers and the squash and all of that. So I would start with plants, you know, and I would plant lettuce and broccoli, and I love collards and any of the cabbages. We're actually growing a cabbage called an O.S. cross, which will get up to 40 pounds.
Oh, my gosh.
It's grown, yeah, it's a one that Bonnie Plant Farm offers for their cabbage program for children. which they give cabbage plants away to third and fourth graders to grow, and these kids can win a $1,000 scholarship in each state of the country when they submit their pictures, and they have to write something up about it. But you cannot believe the size of some of these cabbages these kids have grown. But if they do that, they need to get started. So cabbage is fun. Cabbage is easy. And I would even try, I've taken saucers, big saucers that you put under big containers, like a 24-inch saucer, fill that with a good potting mix, and sow arugula seed or a lettuce in there, and you just take the scissors and you just clip across it like you're mowing the lawn and put it in a colander, rinse it off, and you've got an instant salad.
That's a great idea. So just in a big, like, clay saucer that you have underneath the big pot.
You can't give it, I mean, you got to be careful that it doesn't become too dry.
Right.
Because you have a fairly thin layer of soil, but it works really great, Janine.
Huh, great idea. Interesting, too. So, peas, other types of things that...
Yeah, we didn't talk about peas. Mm-hmm. I love to grow English peas. Mine are already about 3 inches tall. If folks are interested in rhubarb and maybe growing some horseradish, you know, those things need to go into the ground fairly soon. Potatoes are a lot of fun to grow. We actually took several years ago in my small town garden, which is the whole lot is only 100 by 150 feet, we took bushel baskets, cut the bottoms out of them, lined them up along the fence, filled them with good soil, and planted potatoes in them. And you just lift the baskets up and the potatoes just fall out.
Wow.
It was really fantastic. But, you know, my granddad always said he liked to get his potatoes in by George Washington's birthday. So you need to. I'm running a little late. We got almost 300 pounds of potata seed we got to get planted in this acre garden, this food garden we're creating this year.
I hope you feel guilty about that.
I shoot for St. Patrick's Day at least.
Yeah. Well, I think that's I think that's going to be more the target I'm going to hit.
Good.
To be honest. So we had so much rain, we hadn't been able to get into the garden and really get the furrows thrown up. Mm-hmm. But that's a way to grow potatoes if you don't have much room, and it's a great thing to do with children.
How long can people expect that spring garden, because many of these things really will not grow well unless the soil temperature is cool, unless the ambient air temperature is cool. How long can we expect for those to persist into the summer, when then we need to sort of shift our focus on, as you said, tomatoes and other summer crops?
Yeah, I mean, they'll, as you know, Janine, the plant will begin to tell you, your radishes will begin to bolt, meaning they'll put up that spike of flowers. The plant says, hey, I'm done. I'm trying to bloom and set seed for the next generation, and then it's time to sort of get that out of there. Your temperature, you're so right about the soil temperature needs to come up for tomatoes. People just kill me. As soon as they see a tomato in the garden center, they grab it up, even though it's there's a chance of snow the next day, and they run out and try to get it in the ground. And they love the heat, so they just sit there.
Mm-hmm.
They don't grow. You're not getting ahead of your neighbor.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So,
it's one of my pet peeves, in fact. I wait as long as I possibly can to put my tomatoes out because I just don't want them to have to go through a cold night at all.
Well, it's, it damages them, and then you're right back planting them again.
Mm-hmm.
So it's really smart to let things warm up and not get into too big of a hurry. But there's so much early stuff. I mean, we didn't even touch on the radishes and beets and carrots. We could gorgeous carrots.
Mm-hmm.
This last year, there was a red French dragon carrot from Ferry Morris that we planted, and we mixed them with the little small ones, the little baby carrots, and thrown into a roasting pan with olive oil and some garlic. It was just unbelievable.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I grew up in Northern Illinois, sweet corn country, and I love it, but with a small garden, I've always hesitated to plant sweet corn because it takes so much time and space. Is anybody working on a dwarf sweet corn with big ears you can plant in the backyard garden?
Bob, I haven't seen any. I would be interested in that. There's that old pencil cob corn that has a really tiny cob and big kernels.
Right.
I remember my grandparents growing that, but... in my town garden, we never have really grown any corn because we just don't have the room, and you need really, I think, at least three rows wide or four, mm-hmm, so you can get good pollination.
Right.
And then out here at this acre garden, I'm going to try some. We got enough room now where we can, you know, do a big patch of corn. I'm just going to see how it goes. I love that one called Peaches and Cream.
Mm-hmm. I've seen that. I've heard that it's very good. I don't think I've had it, though.
Yeah, no, it really is. And, of course, I grew up on Hickory King and Silver Queen, mm-hmm, that mm-hmm. kind of thing. Right. What are some of your favorites, Bob?
Whatever my wife. You call me colder, man. I haven't planted in so long, I forgot what the favorites are.
You
I grew up on Silver Queen, too, Alan. I remember that one explicitly. Listen, I mean, that kind of begs the question, too, the whole space thing.
Yeah.
And certainly, you know, seed packets usually recommend, you know, how far apart you're supposed to plant things.
Mm-hmm.
But do you ever sort of fudge on that a little bit? You know,
I overplant everything.
Yeah.
You know, I pack stuff in. My motto is too much is just enough. You know, if I pour it in. So you can always thin it. Mm-hmm. And like radishes, I mean, you can, when you thin the radishes, you can eat the baby, you know, the seedlings. I mean, mm-hmm. they're delicious in salads.
Mm-hmm.
But I think the point you make, Janine, is really a good one. In my small garden in town, I never grew corn. I never grew, I grew some squash, but it takes so much room. One zucchini plant is like, you know, Godzilla.
Right.
And it takes a lot of space. So I always tended to grow things that were more expensive in the grocery store.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you know, those really sweet bib lettuces, the oak leaf lettuces. I would grow garlic. I would grow little English peas, mainly to stir fry or just to throw in a salad, and grow, of course, some heirloom tomatoes and peppers that I couldn't get in the grocery store.
Mm-hmm.
So I tend to focus on, you know, and a lot of herbs, because, I mean, think about it. A pack of herbs, a seed pack, is, what, $1.69? Go to the grocery store and look at what fresh herbs cost in normal packs.
That's
you're going to pay $3.54.
Yeah, yeah. Good point.
Just do the math.
Yeah, and many of the herbs, in fact, that we can grow are perennial.
Yeah.
Or at least reseed themselves well.
Sure.
So once you've got them,
you know, what's
got
wrong
them.
With, they've got some great, I love these peat pots. They're offering rosemary in these little peat pots,
mm-hmm.
and you just tear the pot off, stick it in the ground, and you're going to have a rosemary in your garden from, well, this spring. They actually can take some cold. You could plant them now, and they would be glorious right up until Thanksgiving, and you could bring them in.
Mm-hmm. So,
you know, if you plant them in a pot, I like to plant mine in containers.
Yeah. Alan, some great ideas. I think we've inspired some new gardeners, to be sure. Thank you.
Especially me.
Good. Hey, it was a lot of fun, and let's talk a little later in the season and see how things are cooking along.
All right, sounds great.
Okay, happy gardening.
Uh-huh. P. Allen Smith is the host of P. Allen Smith Gardens and P. Allen Smith Garden Home. He's a regular on NBC's Today Show and the author of several books, most recently Bringing in the Outdoors. He spoke to us from his garden in Little Rock, Arkansas. For more information, of course, visit our website at wfpl.org.
Coming up next, a few listener questions and a new Latin word of the week. You're listening to Homegrown on 89.3 WFPL.
Welcome back to Homegrown. I'm Janine Wishy.
Bob Hill, I remain.
And are you thoroughly inspired?
I am.
Good.
I am. It doesn't take much.
I know. I was going to say.
In March, I'm leaning, so I'm going to fall flatward.
A 65 sunny day gets me inspired.
Fall flatward on my face toward the garden.
All right. We've got some other inspired people, some questions, Bob. Actually, these two are similar questions. This one's from Lori. She says but there's some subtle differences.
Right.
She lives in a floodplain near Hikes Point, and she's getting rid of some old sugar maples, and a pear. And she wants to replace them with something that, you know, won't grow too tall, but will provide a nice canopy. Does she have any suggestions? So floodplain's going to be a key for Lori. And then the second one, Rod, he has a friend who had some cherry trees that she lost in front of her house. So she's wondering what replacement trees would give her sufficient canopy to provide shade to the house, but I guess not be too big either.
Right.
What do you think?
Well, you know, I was walking around the yard thinking that thing again, and we don't mention enough about Kentucky coffee trees. I love that plant. It's easy to grow. It's got a beautiful winter bark. It's got a nice upright branching effect, not a real heavy shade, but I think the Kentucky coffee tree can do in a lot of places. It just ought to be used more. Mm-hmm.
I think in the swampy area, the black gum might be a nice choice.
Oh, yeah.
Because they like it sort of wet, or they won't be impacted if it's floody in that area. Mm-hmm. So black gum.
Great fall color, beautiful green leaf. Yeah, mm-hmm. I love it.
Swamp white oak maybe there.
Yep.
But it's a slow growing oak, but and it will get pretty big, but it'll be somebody else's problem by then.
Another one I thought about is the golden rain tree, which I've got. Mm-hmm. I love that tree for replacement for the cherries, maybe. It grows pretty quick. I pruned mine up into this wonderful vase, broad vase shape. I lost a couple limbs, admittedly, in this last ice storm, but not bad.
Yeah.
But I like the thing now. It's got the seed pods. It would turn some people off, but it's got this beautiful gold crown to it when it's in bloom. And the seed pods I like, they rattle and shake all summer and fall, and they will seed around the yard, so it's something to deal with, but it's a different solution to the problem.
Yeah, I think those are good ideas. So there's a couple of ideas for you. All right, one more question from John.
Yeah, he planted asparagus a couple of years ago and will be ready to start harvesting this year.
Mm-hmm.
Do I harvest every spear that comes up, or do I need to let some continue growing to the fern stage?
That's a good question. Actually, and John's doing the right thing, just to sort of point this out for everybody else. He planted it a couple years ago, and now he's ready to start harvesting. Typically, when you plant asparagus, you want to wait several years before you start to harvest, because you want that plant to establish, get energy. The fern that grows takes in energy, so it makes the root stronger every year. So in the third year, you can typically start to harvest. And yes, I would harvest every spear that comes up. That's the, you know, harvestable size. But the key here, John, is to only harvest for about 3 weeks or so, maybe even a month, depending on how healthy you think your asparagus bed is, and then stop, and then let everybody grow up and go to fern. We've had our asparagus bed for years and years and years, so I harvest, honestly, for like 2 months. It doesn't seem to impact it, and then I just, you know, stop altogether and let everything go. So harvest for about a month, everything, and then walk away.
If you have a question for Bob or Janine, visit the Homegrown page at WFPL.org. Email us at homegrown@WFPL.org or call us at 502-814-8246. Well, Miss Wishy, maybe more than you want to know, but today's Latin word I keep finding in my old age in my ears.
Oh, Lord, that is more than I want to know. Not an image I need in my head. Thank you very much.
Right.
Yes, the Latin word of the week this week is cirrus.
Waxy.
C-E-R-E-U-S. It means waxy.
Yeah.
For example, cirrus, it's a cactus genus called the sweet potato cactus.
Huh.
So obviously it's going to be kind of
a waxy cactus.
So let's see. There's cirrus hexagonus.
Lady of the night cactus.
Yes.
With a six-sided shape, apparently.
Exactly. Very good.
Yeah.
Breaking it down.
Yep.
And actually, I looked up some of these other parts of the words here so we could get a better idea of what they meant. Hylocirrus undatus.
The night-blooming cirrus, which is a very well-known plant.
Exactly. So guess what hylo means?
It means 50 watt?
It means wood.
Wood.
So wood, waxy, undatus, wavy-leaved.
Oh.
And what they get woody.
Yeah.
They're waxy, and their leaves are wavy.
Hylocirrus undatus.
Okay.
Perfect.
Pineocirrus greggii, another
night-blooming cirrus.
But the one that we typically see, I think, is the hylocirrus one.
I hope so.
Pineocirrus, pineo, P-E-N-I-O, means thread.
I didn't know that.
So waxy thread.
Oh.
And then the greggii is named after a person.
Yep, Mr. Okay. Greg, no doubt.
And last but not least, erigerin poliospermous variety cirrus.
Wow.
The purple cushion fleabane.
Little fleabane.
That's right.
There's a fleabane for every corner of the world.
There
folks.
Is. And this one, Bob, is what? Waxy. There
yeah.
you go. So if you see cirrus, you know something about that plant is going to be waxy indeed. Well, that ends another edition of Homegrown. Next week on the show, we're going to learn a little bit more about potting soil, this time a whole different ball game, and Kentucky's favorite spring flowering trees, the dogwood and the redbud.
Homegrown is produced by the never slick Brad Yost in the studios of WFPL. I'm Bob Hill.
And I'm Janine Wishy. Join us next week for Homegrown on WFPL.